But sending them out of Iran in thousands in their formative intellectual years, say the ages of 18 to 25, and then expecting them to come back and to be satisfied with a, you know, a total dictatorship that was corrupt. It was sort of crazy. Mm-hmm. And I just kept looking at the people I knew, the ones who were, you know, the local professionals who had studied abroad or who had studied in Iran, and the system no longer fit the people. I also kept, I couldn't help but feeling that the Shah and his family, from the speeches I heard, from the things I saw them do and say, were sort of living in a different world. They really did not seem to know a lot about Iran. They certainly had no contact with the life, you know, the daily life of Iran, or normal people in Iran. They saw the scrubbed peasants, and they saw military officers, and they saw the diplomatic corps, and they took their vacations abroad, and they did their shopping abroad, and they just didn't seem to know what was going on in the country.
Back to some of the events of this period. During the holy month of Ramadan, August 78th, apparently throughout the country, the clergy were taking a greater role in preaching against the Shah in public, or in the mosque. Was this, how evident was this in Tabriz, are they already taking such a role, even in the preceding months, in terms of public preaching against the Shah, the clergy?
I really don't know.
Yeah.
I really do not know. You have to remember it well. Well, I just can't answer.
I've read one of the chronologies of the revolution, that there were riots in Tabriz in August, around August 10th or 11th. Did it ring a bell in particular? What might have...
Not a particular day.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think right now of the first time a consulate was attacked, and I really don't even remember that. I suspect it was the early autumn. But I just do not recall anymore.
Now, some historians of the revolution have noted that by the end of the summer, the protest movements included a growing working class component. Had this already been true in Tabriz? Or was this something that changed?
Yeah. My policeman was certainly a member of the working class. And he was one of many. But when you talk about the working class, don't forget that Iran was always a place where people were underemployed. And so, you know, when you think of working class in the United States, someone who goes to a factory at 8 o'clock in the morning, comes out at 5, it's not quite the same there.
I guess I assumed people were largely employed as well.
Certainly it was attracting, you know, the revolution, the protests were attracting by the summertime, attracting a wide spectrum of people. Not just the working class, you had upper class people, especially their children out there in the demonstrations too. A lot of the political groups, the Mujahideen, you know, whatever, the young communists, the Fedayeen, groups of that sort were not composed of illiterate peasants or illiterate workers. These people were the sons and daughters of the middle and upper classes. If you look today at, or if you looked especially at the beginning of the, you know, beginning of the Khomeini regime, people who took over the government, a lot of them were upper middle class, and they had been very much a part of the revolutionary movement too. As the revolution wore on too, in 1978, there were increasing numbers of Iranians who returned from their schools abroad to take part in it. Just sort of gave up school and came back to Iran. I could not give you figures on that, but I knew people who fit in that category. they started reading about the, you know, the protests and what was happening, the cycles, and just sort of chucked everything here or in England away and came back to take part in it. If you took any crowd, if you took a crowd, a cross-section of any particular crowd of demonstrators in the summertime, in the early autumn of 78, I think you would be more likely to get cross-section or from one particular social strata.
Sort of a cross-class coalition. Or,
yeah. Yeah.
That's the question I've gotten from the various histories.
Would perhaps your upper classes, your educated classes, more likely to be part of a specific group, not just joining crowds at random, but, you know, a specific group of whatever, Mujahideen, Fedayeen, national, you know, national front people, whatever.
Now, on August 19th, of course, there was the tragic fire of the Cinema Rex in Abadan.
Tragic arson at the Cinema Rex.
Yeah. Was there any kind of a response to that in Tabriz?
It caused a sort of a shockwave throughout the entire country. And the credibility gap between the populace and the government was already so wide, including members of the government who didn't believe their government, that it was simply assumed, without any proof, but simply assumed that somehow the government had been responsible for this. That this had either been Sabak or the police or some combination thereof. And as far as I remember, people just went sort of crazy over it. As it turned out, I mean, as far as I know, this was the arson was committed by the revolutionaries themselves, who were trying to, for pardon the pun, you know, set off a spark in that area of Iran. They succeeded. The investigation that was done of the Cinema Rex fire, the investigation that was done in 1979 when the Khomeini regime came into power, basically showed that it had been caused by the revolutionary movement itself, members of it. The investigation report was simply buried. I know people who were involved in the investigation, which is why I say that. Mm-hmm. And they were very, very revolutionary. They were told to forget what they had discovered in the process of doing the report.
Now, in early September 78, there were large demonstrations in Tehran, some of them very peaceful, some more militant. In one around the 8th or the 9th, the crowds were shouting, "Death to the polities," and "We want an Islamic Republic." In terms of the demonstrations that were occurring in Tabriz around this time, were there any people calling for an Islamic Republic as such?
That specifically, I don't remember. What you have to remember, though, about crowds, at least Iranian crowds, is that there were people, crowds were not spontaneous things, they were planned. And the slogans that were being called out were also planned slogans by various groups. People in the crowd would repeat these, but it was more along the nature of a cheerleader calling out a cheer or a chant that people would repeat. One example of that I can give is a crowd in 1979 in the city of Shiraz that was, well, the people at the head of the demonstration were chanting "Death to Talabani." Talabani is a Kurdish leader who's still around. Now he's pro-Iranian regime. At that point he was causing a lot of trouble on the border. But anyway, "Death to Talabani." The people in the crowd didn't know his name, and they thought they were supposed to say "Death to Talagani." Talagani was one of the chief religious leaders of Tehran. So this entire crowd of people in Shiraz, in their thousands, started calling out "Death to Talagani." what the crowds cry out is often not very important. This will sound cynical, but in many cases they simply don't know what they're calling out.
How much did you know? How much did you know about the timing of demonstrations? Did you know in advance?
Basically, yes. I would hear about it either from friends, or a word would get around. Don't go out on the streets in such and such an afternoon. You know, stay away on such a day. Don't go to the bazaar on Wednesday because it's going to be closed and there'll be a demonstration. It was basically common knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And either friends would tell me, or once in a while the police would tell me, or BBC would tell me that there was going to be a demonstration in 2 more days.
Mm-hmm.
And that wonderful way they had of aiding and abetting the planning for it. BBC used to report the news of the future. There will be a demonstration at 10 o'clock tomorrow, starting at...
Now, on September 8th, the Shah declared martial law, and this led to the notorious shootings at Talal Square, the Black Friday incidents. I guess martial law was also declared in Tabriz around this time?
Yeah, martial law was enforced in at different times in different cities.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember offhand whether we had it all the time that it was enforced in Tehran or if we had more of it. But it was basically done by the commander of the city, the military commander, or the governor of the city, would decide when and if it were necessary. And of course, if you left the city limits, it didn't apply. So that sort of caused havoc with the bus time, with the bus schedules.
Mm-hmm.
People who would have to leave the city by 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock to be able to get out before martial law and not arrive in Tehran or another major city before martial law ended and the curfew ended in the morning. You know, you had to sort of plan your trips carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And often wait outside the city borders until you could get in.
Mm. Were there more shootings of people, were the shootings of people still going on in Tabriz? And demonstrations
continued all along. Yes.
Any on a scale, draw a square, or
no, nothing like that in Tabriz.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also funny, information on subjects like that is very much along the, you know, it's very much in the line of the blind man and the elephant. People who were absolutely reputable had full access and every reason to be truthful would say that hundreds had been wounded, and their colleagues who were absolutely truthful had every reason to be, you know, whatever, you know, sincere and had access to the information would say, no, nothing happened. It was very, very difficult to know what was really happening.
Mm-hmm.
I had fairly good information from people who worked in the local hospitals. Certainly had enough friends who were doctors or, you know, medical staffs. And the information was always contradictory. I mean, I can think of examples where people would tell me that, you know, the hospital is filled with the wounded, and someone else, you know, a doctor, would say, no, there's no one here, you know, we're not doing anything for the same incident. So, very, very difficult to get information that was accurate.
Did you ever visit a hospital just to see?
Yes, I did, several times.
Mm-hmm.
I became very solicitous for any friend who was in a hospital for any reason, and visited the sick.
Mm-hmm. And did you get any impressions from all of those visits? Of,
it was a mixed bag. Very mixed bag.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was possible to find out, and sometimes not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, how did you see the situation in Iran in the wake of Jalal Square? Did your take on the situation change in any way, or?
It got worse.
Yeah.
You know, martial law was in full effect, and the military were getting more and more tense, the police were getting more and more tense. People were getting more upset, more open, more vociferous in the conversations. Lots more stuff was being written on walls. You had a lot more minor damage, more demonstrations. The cycle was just going up.
Mm-hmm.
By the time of the winter, early winter, you had a lot of random violence, things like tires set on fire on the streets, and the sort of stuff that points out something is wrong.
Did your perspective on things still diverge from the political officers in at the embassy? Or was there some...
I think, they were gradually realizing that, that things were not rosy. I remember attending a staff meeting. That this was written up in minutes that were later found by the students who occupied the embassy when they were released, but I was at a staff meeting once and they called in the... it was called a principal officers meeting.
It was June 78, maybe?
Possibly.
Early summer. I think I've seen that.
Okay, but you know, they called in me from Tabriz and the guy from Isfahan and Shiraz, and we met with various embassy section heads, and I sat there listening to these briefings on sort of status reports by various sections of the embassy. And it came to my turn, and I just said, you know, I feel like I live in a different country than you all do. You know, what you're saying is simply not true of where I am. You know, literally, you know, they were describing an Iran that didn't exist, or didn't exist for me. And I think there are very good reasons for this, but you'll see that if you compare the reporting, the sort of opinions, the analyses of those of us who were out in the smaller towns with those people who were in Tehran, there's a marked difference.
Did you have access to Thompson's report?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yes,
they were all sent to you.
But one of the reasons is that for us, Iran was a more immediate fact. I couldn't just walk across the embassy compound into the commissary to do my shopping. I had to go out. I was out I was simply out in the city, in the area all the time. I was out I had no social life with Americans. There were Americans there, and I saw them, yes. But my social life was not limited to officers' clubs or the equivalent. It was out with the people of the city. The same is true for Shiraz, the same is true for Isfahan. I mean, our Iran started a few feet away. For lots of people in Tehran, Iran was somewhere else. You could have a very interesting, very pleasant, very sort of fulfilling life in Iran if you were in Tehran and never talked to an Iranian. You didn't have to. You could live in an English-speaking, sort of middle-class America world with your American churches and your American movies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Never eat anything Persian, never talk to a normal, non-English-speaking Iranian. It was not true for us. It was certainly true for the upper echelons of the embassy.
Were there any more conferences involving that you took part in after June, after that one meeting in particular, like in the fall?
We were certainly, I've certainly visited Tehran many times.
Yeah.
But conferences per se, none that I can think of.
During the course of 78, what kind of attitudes towards the United States or Americans generally did you encounter from your various contacts with opposition people, Azari, middle class people, and so forth?
Okay. To start out with the various groups of people in the country, the religious classes had always been anti-Western, but they were anti-everything, certainly anti-American. By the autumn of 78, getting increasing numbers of, you know, things written on the consulate walls on the outside, the walls had always been absolutely clean, you know, freshly painted, always fresh, clean, etc. Nothing ever written on them for years. And suddenly all sorts of things were coming up on the walls. You know, death to Carter and whatever. sorts of things like, you know, go home Americans, go home Yankees, that sort of stuff. There was certainly a strong perception that was given us by the security people that it was becoming physically dangerous for Americans there. And I was getting, I'd say, yeah, you know, by certainly by the autumn, people who would have me to their homes, well, certain people stopped inviting me, let's say that, because they could already, you know, sort of smell the shift in the winds. Other people, you know, friends whose homes I would visit, were very circumspect about having me there. I would sort of be slipped in, as opposed to getting the grand welcome, you know, or the, at the bottom of the walk, it was being slipped into the back door or whatever. They weren't so keen anymore on having their neighbors know that the American consul is visiting. Other than that, it's hard to really point to anything specifically.
Now, after Khomeini, in October, there were more protests after Khomeini was expelled from Iraq. And on the 16th of October, 40 days after Black Friday, there was a general strike around the country. Now, how widely was the strike observed in Tabriz?
I simply don't recall that particular, that specific strike. The, in general, whatever was being called for in the country was true in Tabriz. I mean, the bazaar was closed frequently. You know, schools, etc., were closed frequently. Whatever was, whatever there was an excuse for a closing, Tabrizis took it. You have to remember the Pahlavis had never been popular in Tabriz.
Do you recall much about the impact of the various strikes that were taking place in Tabriz in the fall, early winter of 78?
It had very little impact on my personal life.
Yeah.
The consulate in Tabriz had its own generator. I had always, because of my representational, you know, demands, always kept a huge amount of food in the house. I had several refrigerators, freezers, a large stock of foodstuffs in general, and a good cook who knew how to use it well. So, you know, if you have a couple of bags of rice, 100 or 150 pounds, you can go for a long time and not worry about the effects of a strike. I mean, things like that would not have affected me personally. I remember the frustration of wanting to buy things in the bazaar or needing things for the consulate. I can't think of anything specifically now, but yeah, I can. Things like paint. When we were buying paint locally or, you know, sort of renovation material, plaster, whatever. There was a period when you couldn't get paint because all the paint stores were closed because the bazaar was closed. And so you know, just had to wait until the shops reopened again. Fuel oil deliveries of that sort were certainly constrained. One example, by the way, of the increasing anti-Americanism. We had a very large tank for fuel oil that was buried in the grounds of the consulate. We also had our own gas pump, so that you know, the consulate vehicles and the vehicles of official vehicles could be filled up right at the consulate. Well, for years and years and years, we'd have these filled normally by the oil company. They would come in, fill them, leave. By late 1978, this was getting to be rather a problem. And in fact, in order to fill up for the winter with fuel oil, I had to pull quite a few strings and give some expeditious consideration to one or two visas. Basically also, I think the delivery was done late at night, if I'm not mistaken, as well. The oil companies simply didn't want people to know that they were making a large delivery of fuel oil to the consulate. I remember that specifically because the person who arranged it from the oil company got in touch with me about a year and a half ago and reminded me in a long letter how he had gone about doing this.
Now, on November 5th, there were students shot at Tehran University. There was widespread rioting and destruction in Tehran. This is the day that people call the day that Tehran burned down.
Okay.
Eventually, the Shah imposed martial law and appointed General Azari as prime minister, setting up, you know, the martial law government. What impact did the martial law government have on the situation in Tabriz, if any?
The government of, I'd say, the succession of governments that we had, Chayyid Imami, Azari, the whole slew of Bakhtiar, to the best of my knowledge, didn't have a great deal of impact. Our governor general, who would have been the important person in the government for us, we had one who lasted until the riots of February 1978. He was changed, a successor came in who stayed there until he escaped when Khomeini came into power.
Mm-hmm.
So that government did not change. The mayor of the city didn't change in 1978. One was appointed in the spring, it was a normal appointment, and he was still mayor, you know, in early 1979. The city, the local government, was not affected that much.
Mm-hmm. From your contacts with all government officials, the mayor, the governor general, whatever, what was their outlook on the situation in Iran?
Tabriz said, the two mayors that I knew there were both very sharp, sort of perceptive people. I remember one mayor, the one who was appointed mayor in the springtime of 1978. I was invited to an official dinner, an official military dinner, as a matter of fact. It was in honor of a sports meet, and I was invited to a luncheon where I was one of five or six civilians in a sea of about 100 members of the military, all officers. And I was seated at a table with the mayor, one or two other civilians. The mayor spoke rather decent English. He had been educated in German and had some training, and certainly spoke quite decent English as the new mayor of Tabriz. And this is in early 78, talking springtime. We sat down, and sitting there surrounded by army brass, or, you know, army officers, whatever, the mayor looked at me across the table and he said, in sort of a low voice, "How is Mr. something like, how are Mr. Carter and Mr. Shaw doing?" And it was a rather funny way to refer to the Shaw. And, you know, I didn't know quite what to say, so I said they seem to be getting along quite well. I said, "I understand from the newspapers that the Shah has purchased a new house in the United States." This is when the announcement had just come out that the Shah's family, or the government of Iran, had purchased a house in Lubbock, Texas, for the Crown Prince to live in and do military training. And I had seen it in Parade magazine, like Paris had sent it. I said, "I understand that the Shah has just purchased a new house in Texas." The mayor looked at me and said, "Good, then he'll have a place to go to when we kick him out of Iran." This was not the sort of thing you expected from the mayor of the country's most important, you know, second most important city. A year before the Shah, you know.
And you reported this?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, and that's, I just looked at him when he said that. There wasn't much I could say. If he had said it to me in the privacy of, you know, some private room in the quiet of night, it would have been one thing. But he said it, you know, in the middle of this huge gathering of Iranian military.
And he stayed mayor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure. So
but, you know, you get that sort of comment or attitude from people all the time. And it just exploded as time went on.
Now, during this period, back to the fall again. Did you have any contact at all with, say, DCM, Charles Noss?
Or oh, yeah, sure.
How do they see things from your perspective? What kind of a reading of the situation do they have, say, in the fall?
I think they still... To put it this way, I saw the Shah as leaving on his way out. It was just a matter of the time that he went. I myself, and I looked at, that's what events were showing me, that they had started showing me that by 1977. By 1978, with the demonstration of debris, it just proved to me, and the riots, it just proved to me that, you know, I had been right. It was what close friends have been telling me for the last year. And this was, you know, the evidence of it. Mm-hmm. The embassy took an awful lot longer to come to that conclusion. And it probably wasn't until around December of 1978 that they finally realized their Shah was finished. Charlie Nelson was very, very perceptive, very sharp. Had a very good mind about her own. He had a very open mind, too. In fact, in rather sharp contrast to the vast majority of other embassy officers, he had the most, I'd say, open mind of all of them up there. He was willing to listen, and he did listen, and he would discuss and he would ask questions, unlike a number of the other sort of top layer of the embassy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Unlike any of the rest of the top part of the embassy.
Do you have any contact at all with Nasser Sullivan by this stage, say by the fall? Had you met with him, talked about issues with him? Or,
as far as I remember, I only saw Ambassador Sullivan once before I was assigned to Tabriz.
Yeah.
At most once or twice. And then again, not until I would see Sullivan when I went back to Tehran and took part in the country team meetings, because when any of the principal officers went back on visits to Tehran, we were expected to show up at the country team meetings, which is normal. Saw him again, I think I'm trying to think of what it was, it would have been in the autumn of 78. I'd say roughly October, November, probably October of 78. And I'm not sure of the exact date when I was summoned back to Tehran.
Regarding the circumstances of this?
Yes, for misrepresenting what was happening and for being a, crying wolf, spreading stories about the decline of the Pahlavi regime, and claiming that the dynasty was on its way out. And I had written a particular report which caused a great deal of consternation in the embassy. It was a report on a military matter. If true, it would have meant that a significant portion of the Iranian Air Force had made up its mind to join forces with the revolution. And I had the report from a very good source. I sent it in. It caused a great deal of consternation. The embassy decided the report was untrue, and I was summoned in to be severely reprimanded for rumor-mongering. I found out, of course, I knew the report was accurate when I sent it in, and I confirmed it after the revolution. When people in the military who had stayed on in the military were willing to talk about that particular event or episode and had it confirmed by a number of different sources.
What was the episode? Can you talk about that?
Oh, sure. The episode was, I'd been told that there had been a mass resignation from the Air Force by pilots and others at the base of Tabriz, that this had been accompanied on the same day by a similar mass resignation from the base in Shiraz, that the commanding general at the Tabriz base had gotten together by phone with the commander in Shiraz, and that they had managed to convince the pilots, the others who had stood in line to resign, not to go about with a resignation, that things would be arranged and that changes would be made, you know, that basically the generals had sort of gone over. I reported this, and it was all done, by the way, in for Iran, absolute secrecy. For the mass resignation was handled by the general and one or two people on his staff, on his personal staff as opposed to his official staff.
Well, the Shah would have known about that.
No, the Shah would not have known about this.
The general thing, yeah.
That, that the general in Tabriz, the Air Force general, had, you know, sort of made a deal. Don't resign, we're in this together, we'll handle it together, etc. And if true, this meant that the military were going over already. I reported it, went to the embassy. Went to the embassy very quickly, too. I did it by, you know, the one and only time I used a code book. So I was up going into that. The embassy decided, after due reflection of a couple of hours, that I was wrong because they could not get confirmation of it. And I was very severely reprimanded for starting rumors. In fact, I was summoned to Tehran to be reprimanded, which is, and told that
by the ambassador.
Yes. The general about whom I had reported this became Minister of Defense for Khomeini.
What general was this?
Well, sure, yeah.
I think I know who you mean, but
Lord Imanian.
Yeah. Around the same time, late October, early November, 78, three people from the State Department, Carl Clements, George Griffin from INR, and Stephen Cohen from the Human Rights Bureau, I think.
Yeah.
Traveled to Iran to investigate the situation. Did any of them visit Tabriz?
Yeah, Steve Cohen did. We had a great time, spent a couple of days with him. Took him out to an Iranian village, took him all around the city. Mm-hmm. Basically, he was the deputy assistant secretary, Steve was.
He's Tehran's deputy then.
Yeah. And basically, took him down, you know, through the bazaar, all through the city, wandered out with him. Took him to an Iranian village to show him what that looked like. Spent a couple of very fruitful days with him. He went through all my reporting. Basically, I think came away believing that the collapse was imminent, which is certainly the impression I tried to give him.
Did he give you a sense of current thinking in Washington at that time?
The sense that I had was that Washington didn't know what to think. They were still getting a lot of "there's no problem" reporting, and at the same time they were seeing, you know, contradictory things coming out of the press, etc. There was so much running around and so much information that Washington just did not know what was really going on.
Did any other American officials visit Tabriz in the fall or winter? Besides Cohen?
Certainly from the embassy, yeah. From Washington, I don't recall.
Who from the embassy did?
Oh, that was
that routine? That was
routine. Routine visits, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I have to admit that in the course of my year and a half in Tabriz, I never had a visit from anyone in the political section.
That's all?
Oh, never. They never traveled. Never left North Tehran, as far as I could see. Political section was not interested in what was happening in the rest of the country.